Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, where the number one seeds have restored order, both the Hawks and Warriors tying their respective series at 2-2. Danny, you watched that Warriors game live. What did you think of it?
I thought in a lot of ways it was a kind of a stress release for Warriors Twitter. It was one of those things that there was a lot of angst that was out there, and it was justifiably so. I mean, this was a team that had a lot of expectations that had largely not delivered in this series, though they were only down 2-1. And not only did they win and win convincingly, but they played very well. And I think that was important. And it was to me, it was an interesting duality with the Hawks-Wizards game, because the Hawks won and they played reasonably well, but they didn't instill the confidence in a way that the Warriors did, at least in their fan base, or and put the fear of whatever deity you hold dear in the opposing fan base.
Yeah, I think there certainly is a feeling, which may be an overreaction just as much as the overreaction the other way occurred after games 2 and 3, that order has now been completely restored. You know, Golden State's going to go on to win. I think that is perhaps the likely result, but let's remember that things can definitely shift. Memphis at least has another home game. All they have to do is win that one home game, and you're at a game 7, and then anything can happen in a game 7. So, series certainly not over by any means, but I think that this was Golden State getting back to what they do well. And to me, it all started on the defensive end for them in this game.
Oh, unquestionably. And a not completely original, but very novel and unusual defensive strategy that the biggest part of it, though they had a lot of other nuances that were fun, is that they put Andrew Bogut on Tony Allen, and that is using the most charitable definition of the word "on." That was his assignment that he did not abide by at all. And what it did is, there's something that you and I had talked about before, is that I thought that Memphis had done a good job identifying the weak points on Golden State's offense and treating them as such. And this was the example of that from Golden State towards Memphis.
Steve Kerr confidently said in the presser during the day today that they had a plan for Tony Allen, and boy, did they ever. I just enjoyed everything that Golden State did in this game. They did a lot of the things that we talked about on last night's show. And obviously, you know, we didn't bring up the Bogut idea, which was, I thought, a great idea. And that really took advantage of Andrew's strengths. He, despite being a big guy and a tough guy, is not an unbelievable post defender. And he had actually been getting beaten in the post pretty badly. So, but he is just potentially the best rim protector in the league, right up there with someone like Gobert. And so just having him hang out at the rim, that took away Tony Allen's game cutting to the basket, which hiding him on Curry wouldn't have. The other thing is that the matchups were so funky. They had Barnes guarding Randolph. They had Green guarding Gasol. Curry was on Lee, and Thompson was on Conley. So no Memphis players were able to match up with the guy who was guarding them in transition. That helped the Warriors get out and transition a ton. They also went with the suggestion that you made last podcast, which was really pushing the ball even off of makes. There are a lot of times when Memphis players would score and the camera would cut to them to do the sort of let's zoom in on this guy, he just scored. And then they would have to quickly cut away because the Warriors were pushing the ball up so quickly. And it was really just a wonderful performance for Golden State. We can get to a few of the other things that they did, but to me it all started with the defense, because this is a Memphis team, especially with Allen on the floor, that should not be able to score against the league's number one defense, and the Warriors were able to get back to that in this game.
And a big component of that, we talked about the funky matchups, was also what that allowed them to do, which is that it allowed them to use double teams more and to play the passing lanes differently than they had, and they generated a lot more turnovers, and that helped this team. This is a team that thrives in the open court, and they got a lot more opportunities, and a lot of credit has to go to Harrison Barnes. He played a really great game.
He's been, you know, the most consistent Warrior in this series, and if you look at, you know, he was able to do a great job on Randolph fronting him, and then they had Bogut behind Randolph. Didn't do much at all. I mean, I'm going to quote some stats here, but we'll limit it really to the first through third quarter, since that was really the competitive portion of the game and through which the Warriors held the Grizzlies to 64 points. And they forced 12 turnovers, but nine of those were steals. And so the Warriors were able to get out and transition off of those. And it really, a lot of those came just due to packing the paint. The Grizzlies would drive in, had nowhere to go. The Grizzlies were also horrible at the rim for the game. Mm-hmm. They got 36 shots at the rim, which is actually a very good amount, and they only made 15 of them, so 41%. That was also indicative of the way the Warriors were packing the paint. And then the Grizzlies were a further 3 out of 10 from the paint, not right at the rim. So really just a miserable 18 of 46 shooting performance for Memphis in the paint. And that was all, I think, a function of the strategy. Also just a function of missing some more layups than they normally would. I think it was bad luck. We talked about Golden State missing their open shots and that would regress. I think Memphis making their shots at the rim will improve, just, you know, due to a regression of the mean as well in the next game. But for this game, Golden State's basket protection was outstanding.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Andrew Bogut, his strength is, it's not only as a rim protector, it's as a help defender in those circumstances. And effectively what you're doing with how they decided to structure their defense is you make him, it's kind of like the person who's all-time quarterback when you're playing flag football. All you're doing is you're giving him the thing that he does best, and you're saying, that is your job. And it's hard to do. Marc Gasol said after the game that it was kind of like they were playing a zone. And in a way, it was. And the benefit of that, and the, you know, we talked about illegal defense rules and everything else, is that you can structure Bogut's value in that way. But what was kind of astonishing to me about it was that the Warriors played so well within that framework, and Memphis never really adjusted to it. And the chronology of a series at this point makes this far more interesting, because this isn't where, you know, they're making the adjustment, like, let's say, game one to game two, because while each game for the rest of the series is every other day is also a travel day. So it will be hard for Memphis to adjust, assuming the Warriors use that as a frequent part, maybe not as much as this, but it'll be harder for them to adjust because you don't get those true practices anymore.
That's a long flight. Yeah, it's 4 hours, really, to get to Memphis from San Francisco. So it's you make a good point there about the rest issue. I mean, Memphis did adjust. They took Tony Allen out of the game.
Yeah.
And really, so that means that they might be able to score a little better, although they still weren't able to do much against the Warriors' defense. And then offensively now you're not nearly as formidable. You don't have a guy who's just completely shutting down Klay Thompson. You look at it, you know, you've got Conley, good defender. Courtney Lee, you know, above average, but not a lockdown guy. Jeff Green, pretty average. Zebo, someone who can be taken advantage of pretty mercilessly, and they certainly did that against him. That was something that we'd been calling for in the podcast, to kind of simplify things and really go after him more, break the flow offense, and they mercilessly attacked him. And then Gasol, you know, a good guy at the rim, but still someone who has to, when you have to get out on shooters like Klay or Steph Curry, it reduces his effectiveness at the basket. And you saw that it sort of turned into fun time again for the Warriors, especially in that 61-point first half where Steph Curry was able to kind of, you know, bounce around, had the space to do a bunch of fancy dribbling. The ball was pinging around. And that's all because they just had so much more space on the floor. And it was really beautiful to watch. Good to see the Warriors getting back to the offense that really powered them throughout much of the year.
And while it's better for the Warriors for their guys to get to the rim and get to the line, they have a group of players that are very comfortable taking mid-range shots. And so when you're talking about the space that you create, because you have to have whoever's on Klay or Steph, assuming the other guy is on the perimeter, you have to keep them hugging. And if you're going to have Marc Gasol pretty much, you know, as a rim protector, you're going to have a seam there. You're going to have some space. And one of the things that Stephen Curry does, the strongest parts of his game, is he knows exactly how much space he needs to get his jump shot off. And they did a nice job of getting into that space but not getting all the way in and getting some floaters, getting some runners, and that doesn't have to be a part of the offense, but when you start to make the opposing defense think about that, then that can also, you can counter into helping, you so you can get threes, or you can counter into getting more to the line and getting passes and forcing help. And I thought the offense looked, as you said, it was more closer to fun times. You know, this was more of what we have seen from them in both the first series and in most of the regular season.
Another thing that we talked about was just emphasizing defense more. We saw Sean Livingston come in as the backup shooting guard for Klay Thompson in the latter half of the first and third quarters rather than Barbosa. That allowed them to keep the defense rolling. And when they had Livingston and Iguodala in there, Iguodala, which was key also, that he was able to make some jump shots and make himself get guarded. And Livingston didn't have a great offensive game, but also you can only help off of someone so much when you're running a pick and roll with Draymond Green and Steph Curry 25 feet from the basket and Zach Randolph has to get out there. Usually with Randolph getting out there, you can get a good look with, you know, just that two-man combination. And if Sean Livingston's hanging out on the baseline as the dunker, it's hard to get his guy over to provide additional help. So just by simplifying things, attacking Randolph, they're able to get by offensively and still maintain that impregnable defense once Klay Thompson went out of the game. And Klay Thompson was fantastic on the defensive end, although he took some pretty bad shots offensively. That didn't matter too much in this game.
Yeah, his offensive game was frustrating in that sense that he, not only did he make some mistakes, but he just took some terrible shots, which he does sometimes. You know, he has the confidence to do it, and he didn't have anything as bad as that runner three that he had in game three, but he had that. And the other guy that we have to single out for some praise is David Lee. I have been one of the more vocal critics of David Lee basically his entire tenure in Oakland. And he did a nice job. He wasn't Andrew Bogut out there, but he provided effort, and he wasn't a sink out there, which is very important. And one of the things that you and I have talked about, and I've talked about to anybody who will listen, is that what the Warriors need is 48 solid minutes from every spot. And I think that's how they can beat teams in the playoffs. And if they face the Clippers in the next round, that would be a major storyline in that series. And if they can get something like that from David Lee in, you know, 10 minutes or so, that's a huge plus for them.
You know, I think I'm going to have to disagree with you, actually. I didn't think Lee was that great. He wasn't terrible,
though.
Well, he was terrible in the third quarter.
Oh, that's
true. He just got owned by Gasol. He had to be taken out. They had to put in Azeli because he was getting completely destroyed.
That's true. And I was thinking first half.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's fine. He was. I would say that he was okay in the first half and pretty bad in his second stint in the third quarter. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that he was any worse than Spates would have been. So he was able to hold down the fort okay. I think once Memphis really started attacking him, and when he was trying to play as the center, that's when things kind of really went downhill for him. So yeah, I'm not like convinced that David Lee is going to be some big help moving forward. There's a segment of the fan base that just loves him and thought that he was going to be the big answer because they can't score, so you put David Lee out there. That was not the answer. I mean, it was nice to see that he at least could feel like he was contributing, but I think that he's someone whose minutes are still going to need to be minimized as much as possible going forward, frankly.
Oh, yeah. No arguments there. I mean, he's not going to win this team games, but if he doesn't lose them games, I think that's a benefit. That's a plus.
So yeah, a couple other notes here. Really, the Warriors, it signaled what was going to happen early on, and offensively they had a couple of nice backdoors using Memphis' aggression against them to Thompson against Allen. That was something that really had been missing in the previous games. They made their threes more than they had. Steph was unbelievable, and two or three more of his open threes and those games two and three go down, then maybe we're not talking about this being big redemption, but that kind of regressed back for him. I mean, I think even a lot of his looks were tougher than some of his looks were in games two and three, but he's a great shooter and those are going to go down. He was 4 of 8 through the first three quarters. So he was really fantastic there. And, yeah, you know, I guess the question is, this can get to one of our listener questions. What are you going to do now if you're Memphis to deal with this new tactic on Tony Allen? Because I think that they need him.
Yeah, I agree with you that they need him. The two things I thought of that are both, they tried both of these, but that weren't completely effective, but I think they can emphasize more, especially with, you know, more practice, is one, using Tony Allen as a screener more often and understanding that, because if his man is hanging back, then basically what that means is that you're asking a lot of the screen E. If you're the Warriors defender, because you basically have to get around it, and there's a lot of space that's created by that. The downside with that is that, first of all, Tony Allen hasn't done a ton of that in his career, and also you're probably going to be generating mid-range looks because you still have Andrew Bogut hanging out where Andrew Bogut hangs out. So you want to be creating those looks for very specific people on this team. And the second thing, which I think is something they can use more, but again, it's fighting Tony Allen's instincts, is driving, getting him the ball and driving not for a shot, but driving just to create chaos. And so the Warriors are a team, and this goes back to the Mark Jackson, Mike Malone teams, that is very aggressive in terms of help. And you can use those instincts against them by taking somebody who isn't as much of a threat, but just going, oh, there's a guy here, danger, danger, and moving around and hopefully creating a seam for somebody else, probably actually Gasol or Zebo.
Yeah, I certainly think both those things might be worth trying, but they both have really some flaws. One was the mid-range that, you know what I mean? And the reason why someone like Bogut on the Warriors, he would probably be too much of an offensive liability to play on a lot of teams, but because the Warriors have Curry and Klay, the big man guarding him has to guard him, because otherwise he'll just do a dribble handoff or a screen for Curry or Klay, and then you got a three. And Memphis doesn't really have that caliber of shooters, and, you know, Tony Allen is not really used to operating at the elbows like that anyway, to where, you know, you're going to be that concerned about it. If they want to have Tony Allen do dribble handoffs and have a guy shoot a mid-ranger with, you know, someone like Thompson trailing behind and bothering the shot, I'm sure the Warriors will take that. And then, you know, Tony Allen driving to the basket, well, you know, he can't pull up, so he's got to go all the way to the rim, and Bogut's not going to come out at all. And then he's not really much of a dribbler or passer either. So, you know, he's going to be driving into traffic. No one else is going to help on him. Bogut will just be standing there. I mean, maybe you give him a shot to make a few from, you know, 10 feet, 12 feet, 15 feet. But yeah, I'm not sure there's a great option. You may just have to live with it again, because I think that without him, they don't have much of a chance of stopping Golden State. So you're just going to have to try and come up with some things with him out there. But there's not a great solution. I think this is going to be something that's really going to be hard for Memphis to deal with.
The other question, we can get to it quickly. It's from Drew Davis. So how, Drew, do you do? Is how would you – no, sorry, it's not from him. It's a different question, but it's actually, I think he asked one that was similar. And the question is, how would you handle the pace of the Warrior second unit? Would you slow down to address the fact that they don't really have great offensive weapons?
Well, I don't think that I necessarily would. I think you still, in fact, want to push for easy buckets more, A, because that's still a very good defensive unit, and so you can get out and transition that way, and B, because those are guys who are all athletes, a lot, you know, guys like Livingston, Iguodala, but aren't great in the half court, aren't great shooters. In a lot of ways, you want to push the pace more when you're not any good in the half court.
Yeah, I'll add that the question, I got the correct person. It's Chris Brummett, so it's Chris _ Brummett, number 6. So, yeah, I agree with you that when you have a lineup that is offensively challenged, is something I've harped on the podcast before, that's when you want to run most, because that's when you generate looks. And so if you don't get a look early, then I think you'd be patient. I think that you're not going to be satisfied with a deep two with that kind of lineup, because, you know, with 14 seconds on the shot clock. But that's a very different question. And I feel like also one of the things that the Warriors did nicely in this, and partially was helped by Livingston playing more with Curry, is that it felt to me like they had less times with really offensively deficient lineups out there, and they can do that. This is a team that can mix up their rotation players pretty well if they want to, and they've played in a lot of those alignments over the course of the season.
A few more points here. The Grizzlies really have two very effective ways of scoring. One is using Marc Gasol in the pick and roll. That's worked very well for them. That's totally obviated now by having Bogut standing right under the basket and able to help out on any pick and rolls. Or Green. When Green got in foul trouble, they switched him onto Allen and they had Bogut guarding Gasol instead. Green also an excellent help defender despite his shorter stature. So that's one way. That's totally taken away by that strategy. Another one is the post-ups. You had Barnes working hard to front. He had some great quotes after the game about how they basically got punked physically, and he had spent all last year upset about how he hadn't been physical enough in that series against the Clippers, or all last summer he was worried about that, and he played a really physical game. He's a lot stronger than he looks, and with him fronting Zebo and then the help there with Bogut, they weren't able to get Zebo the ball. He was minus 21 in those first three quarters, and that was indicative, really, of his defense and the fact that he wasn't able to make much of a difference on offense. And the other thing I would say, too, is that the Warriors just played harder. We talked about the fact that Bogut and Green needed to play better. They were much better. Green hit some threes in this game, which he hadn't been doing. And also, they just got to a lot more of the loose balls. And I think one of the guys who was most instrumental in that, you don't think of him this way, was Curry. He was really getting in, contesting every rebound. He hasn't gotten enough credit this year for the increase in his rebounding. He's one of the best rebounding point guards now. And then when he gets a rebound, he can grab and go, and that really fuels the break. But seeing him really stick his nose in there on those rebounds, even as not a particularly athletic guy, just try for it. That really helps to set the tone to see your best player providing effort, even at something that he naturally wouldn't be that good at.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something that has been funny for me. And I heard a little bit of it. You weren't on obviously on Twitter during the games. People were surprised that Curry was out rebounding Klay, and he does that all the time. He's a better rebounder than Klay Thompson is. And a lot of that's because he tries more often, and in this series, he's going to actually be in position more often, but he's done such a nice job of adding that you think of it as a small thing for a point guard, but when you look at some of the most successful point guards in the league, a lot of them actually now, and this is somewhat of a rarity, have that in their skill set.
Mike Prada also had a great point, and it's something I think we've talked about a little bit on Twitter before, if not on the podcast, is missing a lot of layups really fuels the other team's transition game. And there's a statement that, oh, if you miss jumpers, there's long rebounds, that fuels the break. I totally disagree with that, because when you shoot a jumper, by definition, the guy shooting is away from the basket unless he's shooting from the corner. And a lot of times, guys just won't be in position for the offensive rebound. They'll kind of give up and start getting back on defense. When you miss a layup, it's usually, especially if it's someone driving, he usually ends up kind of under the stanchion or even into the photographers, can't get back. You'll have guys go for the offensive rebound. If they don't get it, that really is what fuels breaks much more. And especially if it's a block shot, that helped the Warriors a ton in this game.
Yeah, I credit Matt Steinmetz as being the person for me who really instilled that, because we watched games when I started covering the Warriors, and he would say something to the effect of a missed layup leads to a layup for the other team. And because as you said, it leads to so many challenges for the team that is now defending in transition just with where their people are.
So do we have any more questions on this game before we move on to Hawks Wizards?
Let me take a quick look and see if there's anything.
Here's one. This is from, I don't know if it's Jan or Jan Studebaker. Did you see Barnes being able to front/guard Randolph much more effectively than Draymond? No, I did not see that.
No, I didn't, but it's something that makes more sense in hindsight. It's funny to think about now, but after game two, I think it was game two or game one, somebody asked Coach Kerr about Harrison Barnes' success. It might have even been my question. I think it was somebody else's. But and he talked about how Harrison is much stronger than people think.
Sure.
And how so Draymond is a very good defender, but that's not really what he's good at. And so in that sense, it's one of those things that it surprised the hell out of me. I openly admit that. But I now thinking about it and thinking about, you know, what their physical statures are, I think Harrison has a nice base. And as you said, it's something that he does care about, that it does make some sense. And also Harrison has had those assignments in the past. I mean, when he was in that Denver series, he was largely, from what I recall, he was largely guarding Kenneth Fareed, which is not an easy cover for a guy. And that was his rookie year.
Let's also not forget that while Barnes was doing a nice job and it was fronting, a lot of it too was the fact that the Warriors were able to help so much more effectively. And when you've got Andrew Bogut behind you, it's a lot easier to be aggressive fronting the post. So
yeah. And he has a very light offensive assignment as well. So he can put his energy into that. That's his job on the court for that game.
Yeah. And he's not someone who is as wired to have help responsibilities as Bogut and Green are. So he was able to basically just concentrate solely on denying Zebo position and being in position to front him rather than kind of getting sucked into help and then getting ducked in, which is what was happening to Green especially and also Bogut in those previous games. So really just a wonderful adjustment from Kerr. And then once you got Allen off the floor, yeah, things might open up a little bit for Memphis offensively, although they weren't able to do a ton anyway. But more importantly, then the Warriors are going to outscore Memphis, I think, once Tony Allen is not locking down Thompson and getting into the passing lanes and making life miserable for the Warriors dribblers. So one more question on this game. This is from L. Sawyer. Handle is Cool Han, H-A-H-N, Luke. Is Steph's success just shots falling again, or is he taking better shots?
It's both. He was missing shots that he normally makes earlier in the series, but he was also getting different looks. He was getting closer to the rim, and he had more clean mid-range shots in this game than I remembered in the series. He had a lot of those in the New Orleans series, though they did a decent job protecting that as well. But I thought it was a little bit of both. I mean, there were some looks in the earlier games that I was surprised he missed. He makes those very often, and he's a guy who makes shots that you don't think of as automatic feel automatic. That's just part of what makes Stephen Curry an MVP despite his unusual build and role. And he wasn't making those shots early in the series.
I do think that a lot of it too was the fact that they put the ball in his hands a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see, there were a bunch of plays in the previous games where he was sort of involved in this hand fighting with Conley, was getting held, got denied the ball, couldn't get the ball. They put it in his hands a lot more. They ran handoffs with him and whoever Zebo was guarding, pick and rolls with him and whoever Zebo was guarding, especially in transition. And so I think the strategy was a little bit better. You saw him just able to get more space. His plan, too, was that he was going to attack more off the dribble on whoever was hedging out on him, especially when that was Zebo. He was able to have success with that, really force an additional help man and then get the rotations going and then keep moving off the ball. So I think, you know, it just his general activity, getting out in transition more helped, but also it was just making shots. So it's a combination of those.
Okay, ready to move on to the other game?
Yes. I would like to say that karma finally got to Paul Pierce after he was completely unwilling to show any humility about his totally lucky banked-in game winner in the previous game. He missed a wide-open three that could have tied it in the last 10 seconds of the game, and I think that is quite deserved from a karmic standpoint.
Yeah, I'll go along with that. There are a lot of interesting things in this game. One of them was Washington's consistently good out-of-bounds plays, which was kind of funny.
Playoff women!
Something I need to add here. I covered the Wizards for 3 months this year. I didn't see very much of this during the season. Like, that's why the playoff Whitman thing has so much resonance for me, is that this isn't a team that, you know, I just saw bits and pieces of. I covered them for 3 months, and this was not a part of their game. Mostly.
Yeah. Jeff Teague was fantastic in this game. That was a big part of Atlanta's success. And they were able to get the offense going better than they had in previous games, especially early on in that first half when they put up 65 points. And Teague ended up 9 of 20 from the field, a further 6 of 7 from the line, 26 points. But he was able to get into the lane all day. He also had 8 assists. And really, he had to win his matchup with Sessions. And Sessions finally started to get exposed on defense. He's not a great defender. He had done okay. But then really over the course now of 3 games having to guard Teague, it seemed like he's starting to wear down a little bit. And if not wear down, just be exposed a little bit more. So that was key. The only note I do have on Teague, which is a bit of a non sequitur, but the guy just has no left hand whatsoever, and he's actually great at penetrating to his left, and he'll have the advantage, and if he just took another step and finished with his left hand, it would be easy. He always either tries to do the sort of like corkscrew right hand on the left side under the guy's arm, or he'll just have to bring the ball back into the guy for a floater. Neither of those work that well, so I think that's something that he could really stand to do, because he's not that explosive of a leaper, but he's quick. So if he can work on his left hand and finish, and Schroeder has the same problem, actually, not a great left hand either. And that would make both those guys way more effective if they could just continue to press their advantages when they go left and finish left instead of having to bring the ball right back into their defender.
Yeah, the only other thing I'd add with Teague is that the Teague-Schroeder combination actually worked better in this game, though I was still beyond floored that they used it in some closing the game situations.
Well, it was interesting because Damari Carroll, who arguably had been the Hawks' best player in this series, and I don't want to say that there was something mental going on after kind of that weird close to Game 3 that we talked about on yesterday's episode, but he was 2 out of 8, only had 5 points, 2 of his shots blocked, and was -9 in this game when every other Hawks starter was pretty good, and there's only one other guy who was in the negative on the whole team. So kind of a rough game for Carroll. Didn't play nearly as much as he had, and he was the guy who was out a lot in favor of that two-point guard alignment with Teague and Schroeder.
Yeah, he was. And it one of the storylines of this series is that they're continuing to keep Kyle Korver on Bradley Beal, who had a fabulous game. I feel like Beal deserves a lot of credit for how well he played, even in a loss. But would you switch that matchup?
Well, so, yeah, Beal, 34 points. He got to the line 9 times, making 8 of them. That's something that he's not done a ton of in his career. Able to get up 25 shots, which is good for him, too. 44 minutes in this game. He was really pretty excellent, probably one of the best games of his career. And then also they were getting their butts kicked by Paul Pierce, although Pierce was hitting some somewhat contested threes. I think when both Pierce and Beal are killing you, maybe you should switch up those guys and see if one of them has something that can stop the other guy. I mean, I think Beal is a greater threat. You would normally think you put your best wing defender on him. We've talked about that on past episodes, so maybe give Carroll a shot, although Carroll was just as bad defensively in this game. He got sucked in a lot of times, wasn't able to have his normal level of activity on closeouts. He was passing up shots by the end of the game from three. Really just a weird, disappointing performance from him. But fortunately, he was picked up by Horford, who was tremendous again in this game. Paul Millsap was able to score 19 points, one of his first efficient games of the playoffs, and only 13 shots. So I totally understand why they didn't go with Carroll down the end. But yeah, I think I might try changing those matchups. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But those guys have both been going pretty well, so you might as well see if there's something better out there.
Yeah, and in light of his good game, something that I like, I've brought this up before, but we're getting close to the actual date, is that Bradley Beal right now, and he had a huge game tonight, he's still younger than Klay Thompson was when Klay Thompson played his first NBA game. And while that's not the end-all, be-all of any sort of stat, I do think it's interesting that as we think about his career, that he came in so young for a guy at his position, because he was a young freshman in college when he came out after 1 year, that while NBA age and real age are very different things, I'm still excited for how much better he can get.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think he can improve in some of the same ways that Thompson has, where he's has been a guy who's probably, just based on his regular season performance, been a little overrated, but he's been a solid 40% shooter from three. He's probably not quite the shooter that Thompson is, and doesn't quite have the quick release, but he's more dynamic off the dribble, better passer. So I definitely think that if he, especially with this newfound Wizards emphasis on the three, and he got up 8 three-point attempts and made 4 of them in this game, if he can trade in some of those long twos for threes and continue to be more of a playmaker, he could definitely blossom into an all-star type player for Washington.
And it's also fun with that comparison, because I think they both have the potential. Well, Clay's potential has turned into production on the defensive end, that Clay has become a good defender. He's more of a kind of, I think of him, Clay is more of a 2-3 defender, and Beal is more of a 2-1. But yeah. Clay, but you say that, and Clay Thompson has been defending by Conley for the last two games of that series. So I'm excited to see it, because the two guard position is one that isn't, I don't think it's central unless you have, you know, an all NBA type guy, but I really like those players that can be a substantial contributor and not be a detractor on the other end. And I think both those guys have that in them. Well, Clay's already there.
Yeah, so Nene had another nice game for Washington. Pierce and Beal were good, as we mentioned, but we're finally starting to see a little regression from some of these Washington bit players. Porter, only 1 out of 4 in 30 minutes. Drew Gooden, 1 out of 6. The Hawks were really able to take advantage when he was in the game. The Hawks bench units were actually able to be effective, really for the first time in the playoffs, essentially. And a lot of that was because they just switched everything involving Gooden, and basically, you know, rather than letting him get shots off or letting somebody turn the corner when he was trying to do his pick and pop, they just switched it and said, all right, Drew Gooden, if you want to try and beat us, post it up against a point guard, and you know, maybe we'll just double team you if you get down too low and make you make a pass, which he's not really that great at. So Drew Gooden wasn't able to beat them with that strategy, and that ground the offense to a halt on some of those possessions for the Washington bench unit. And Marcin Gortat also had a pretty miserable game, 1 out of 7. He had been making seemingly like all of his kind of hooks and floaters, and none of those really went down for him in this game. So, the Hawks started shooting a little bit better. They were, 9 out of 19 on threes in this game. And Washington, although they shot well on threes, a lot of those kind of guys reverted back a little bit closer to their regular season norms. And that was a big deal as well for the Hawks winning this one.
Yeah, they also had 30 assists on 41 made baskets, which is very good for them. And one thing that I was intrigued by, considering that they both had a role in the comeback in Game 3, is that Shelvin Mack and Mike Scott both got DNPs. I don't think it's a huge thing. I'm not reading anything into it. I think part of that was that Schroeder played well. Also, I think Muscala's done a nice job in this series.
He has, and last year, when we saw him at Oracle, he was just completely overmatched, and he still really suffers from not having enough strength. There were a couple times when he got matched up against Nene, and the Hawks really had to get him out of that matchup. He's just not strong enough or athletic enough. But as long as there's no one who's going to post him up, he can be pretty decent as a bench guy. He's, I think, with this great Hawks player development system, he's another guy who hasn't really played much all year, but now, you know, he hit that tying three. He's starting to hit jump shots. They're getting to where they have to respect him outside. And he took some minutes from Apero Antić, who only played 14 minutes, less than what he usually does. And as long as Muscala isn't going up against a big post guy, I think he should probably take more of Antić's minutes as time goes on.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And yeah, I mean, to me, Muscala is the best big off their bench. And if he's healthy and ready and all that, I think Scott is probably second best.
Yeah, I don't know. Scott really is one of the worst players in the league by real plus minus. I don't know if I agree with you there. And I think his his defense and rebounding are a real problem. I would continue to give Muscala minutes and give Scott the DMP and let Perro kind of bang around a little bit. I think Perro is probably still a better option than Scott is, especially because you need a center type against this Washington team. Maybe you might go with Scott more against a team that doesn't quite have the behemoths that Washington does up front. But
that's fair.
A few things to talk about down the end of this game. Washington was down three. They got a defensive rebound, and Sessions pushed the ball up court. No timeout was called. I thought Whitman actually played it perfectly. Sessions was sort of out of control, just dribbling towards the sideline. Didn't really have anything as there was about 10 seconds left. And so I think that's the way you play it there, is you let your guys push it up. If it looks like you're not going anywhere productive, then you call the timeout. And Whitman had three awesome sideline out of bounds plays as they're trying to come back here. A couple of curls, one where Carroll could have helped, didn't. They just got a layup. They really had two easy layups on sideline out of bounds, just curling guys off the elbow within like 2 or 3 seconds, which are just a killer when you're ahead trying to stop a team from coming back. At least make them waste 10 seconds. And then they also got that wide open Pierce three when, you know, everybody knows you're going to him. And I think the Hawks just were unable to help out at all. Granted, the Washington bigs set unbelievable screens, but especially on that Pierce three, you got to be switching or at least have some sort of an emergency understanding by whoever's guarding the screener that this is Paul Pierce breaking out for a three. A three is the only thing that's going to hurt us here, since we're up by three with 10 seconds left. Like, you got to have someone get on him. He was wide open.
Yeah, the way I think about it is the worst case scenario is that. So you, even if you force Pierce to make a pass and somebody else gets an open three, the worst situation may be slightly Bradley Beal getting an open three, but really Pierce hitting that shot, you know, him having a clean look, is that. So you do everything you can to mitigate that. And they didn't, and they got, I wouldn't say they got lucky, because that's not a more likely than not shot to go in, but they didn't get as unlucky as they did in game three.
Horford, we talked about, was fantastic in this game, and his shooting really was key to opening things up for that 65-point first half. He was killing Gortat on just pretty easy two-man game, pick and pops, and then, you know, draining 17-footers off of those, forcing Gortat away from the basket, I think was huge for the Hawks. And then they were able to really get going in the paint. They had a ton of points in the paint in the first half. Another note was there were some awesome plays in this game, like Paul Millsap putting a guy in the mix, going through three dudes and hitting an amazing reverse layup. Nene had that dunk. I forget who he got. Was that Horford that he got on that dunk?
It might have been. I'm not completely sure, but I know the player you're talking about.
I think it was where he was fronted in the post. They threw it to him, and he, like, cocked it back and then sort of, like, brought it to the left. He's got huge hands, and he had a couple of dunks. That one was incredible. Horford had a really awesome alley-oop. Not teams that you think of that have a ton of highlight plays, but there are some sweet dunks in this game.
And if you like screens, there were a lot of nice screens in this game, too. Honestly, yeah, right, like...
Right. Way to calm me down. Sorry, I was getting a little too excited about the dunks.
No, there were. I'm somebody who likes a good screen, which makes it fun with this Warriors team, because this Warriors team has some of the better screeners. But there was one, I think I tweeted about it. So it was a play, Nene just crushed. I can't remember who it was. And it was so bad that it was one of my favorite plays of the game. Nene drilled a guy on a screen, which led to, I think it was Beal getting an open three. And then he missed it. And then Nene got the rebound and a dunk. And so it's kind of like, oh, wait, he screened a 3-point line and got in time to do that. And it's just kind of an idea of, you know, that's what you want your big men to be able to do.
All right. Anything else on this one before we get to a couple more questions and close it up?
Nothing particular. Well, do you think that are we in the same boat that we were before, that if John Wall doesn't go back in the series, the Hawks are going to win?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's more. I think they're pretty big favorites now. Going to be at home in Game Five. Maybe Washington wins Game Six, and then, you know, I think 80% of home teams win Game Sevens, right? And I think Atlanta is a you know, probably Atlanta versus a wall-less Washington is probably a more lopsided at home game seven matchup than your average one necessarily would be. So I think still like Atlanta in the series. Washington, I think, is finally going to be in trouble. They made a nice comeback in this game, but I think Atlanta was pretty much in control most of the way.
Yep, I agree with that.
All right, so a couple more questions. The first one here is from Pop the Trunk at B-Ball Narratives. What happened to Houston's defense?
Patrick Beverley being hurt happened to Houston's defense.
No, that was huge. I mean, and during the regular year, their stats weren't that much better with him on the floor than off. But also, you know, he's going up against starters. I think definitely when you're going against Chris Paul, having him, especially with Paul being a little hobbled, especially in game three, that would have really been helpful. Just a little bit more grit, a little bit more effort that can become infectious is really key. I think Harden has regressed quite a bit defensively, whether it's the bigger burden of scoring in the playoffs or what it is, I don't know, but he hasn't been himself. And the power forwards, especially Terrence Jones, have really been getting taken advantage of in their one-on-one matchups. I think a lot of it is just not having the good guys to guard one-on-one, whether it's Redick coming off of screens. I mean, you having nobody who can guard at the point guard position means now you have to put someone like Ariza on the point guard, or Corey Brewer, who's not really even that good at it anyway. Then you've got Terry or Prigioni chasing around someone like Redick, and they've done the best they can, but they're not good defensive players anymore. They're 37 years old. So that's going to be a problem. And then you've got no one really who can guard Blake Griffin one-on-one except for Dwight Howard, who you need him to be able to help a little bit more. And then you just don't have the level of cohesiveness that you would like either. And it's just you don't get the sense that there's a lot of urgency or effort. Who are the real effort guys on this team? Maybe it's Brewer, but he's also not a particularly disciplined defender as well. And unfortunately, I think you got to look also back at the coaching now, where we had some questions about Mikhail. They kind of got it together. And maybe you also have to consider that this regular season result from them was a little bit of a mirage. They were second throughout most of the year, but a lot of that, as Seth Partnow pointed out during the year, was based on just an inordinate number of missed open threes. And I think that started to revert back to the mean as the year went on. Beverly went out. They finished the year sixth, so they were defending a lot worse down the end of the year as they had been in the beginning. And so whether it's making open threes, whether it's losing Beverly, whether it's, even Monty Unis might have been a little bit better of an option. He's not that great either than some of the other guys they have at power forward. All those things, I think, combined, not having an amazing defensive coach, and now you're here. And I mean, also you're playing the best offense in the league. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the juxtaposition of doing that and then playing after playing Dallas, who was a train wreck pretty much in every way, but especially offensively, was something that, you know, it kind of made that series look like an oasis. But we can move on to the next question. The next one I liked was from Ryan, whose handle is Icarus Descends, which I like. And the question was, is a crunch time worthy stretch four requirement for playoff success in today's NBA? And would Memphis be better with one?
I don't know. I think that they won these games that they won because they were playing differently. As we talked about on yesterday's show, their offense is a little bit different than what Golden State is really built to face, kind of this modern offense. They're a little more old school. They're pounding it into the post. That's not something that Golden State is that used to defensively. So I don't think that, at least for Memphis, that would have helped that much. I mean, I think Golden State loves when you go small because they're going to be better at it. They have someone like Green who can shoot the ball but still do the switching and the basket protection aspects and, guard guys in the post in a pinch as well. of being a stretch four. There aren't a lot of the guys like that who can go around. So if you're going to have a stretch four, you're going to either have a guy who's going to give it up on the rebounding or protecting the basket, or is going to be a guy maybe like Ryan Anderson, who you might as well just put a wing on him anyway, and then he's not going to be able to guard the wing. So I don't think it is a prerequisite. I think that if you're going to have one, it's really important, but it's really important to have that guy be someone who can also defend, whether it's Boris Diaw in San Antonio, it was LeBron or Shane Battier in Miami on those great teams. It's Draymond Green in Golden State. And certainly the Clippers, their offense is plenty good, but they got Blake Griffin. He's a fantastic player. I don't think it is a prerequisite. It helps. But I think that guy better be able to defend. He better not be a one-way player. Now, if you got a guy at the four who can shoot the ball and defend, then you got something.
Yeah, and I think the way that I would phrase it is that it certainly helps, but it's not required. I think it's the issue, and you and I are both lawyers, that we get into is the strength of the question as opposed to the concept. And I think that we're seeing that with Nikola Mirotic, that having a guy who can do that is very useful. But the challenge with the NBA, and this is just generally true, is that, elite talent is more important than just that concept. And the other team that I would add in there is when Oklahoma City was making their run before they traded James Harden. At that time, Serge Ibaka was not a stretch four at all, and their defense was very good. They obviously had a ton of really, really good talent. But what I would say is the difference is having a guy on roster. Maybe you don't close games with them, but I think that having somebody who you can have out there for at minimum 15 to 20 minutes is really, really becoming not mandatory, but closer to that than it ever has been, because it allows, and this is something we've seen from the Warriors, it allows your perimeter players to do so much more. And when you have to respect that shot, and I think the next evolution of that is probably going to go more that direction, especially as the center position is not as strong and as top heavy as it used to be, is going even further and having some stretch fives that can still defend the rim. And Karl Anthony Towns might be one of those. Anthony Davis might be one of those in a couple years. And that will be exciting too, because that will be another way of challenging an opposing defense.
Yeah. So it's an important part of the game. It's not essential. If you have a guy who's good enough at some of the other aspects, if you have enough talent elsewhere on the floor that you can still score without having that stretch at the four. But, it does help as long as you're not sacrificing in other areas.
Yep.
All right, I think that'll put a bow on today's show. You can follow me on Twitter, usually live tweeting during the game. So is Danny. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. We're Dunked On is available on iTunes. Giving us a rating is always much appreciated. And we will talk to you after tomorrow night's games. Thanks again for listening.